This is 2.1, a Netrunner Reboot Project podcast. Episode 37, Run with the Best. Again. Hey, this is Remy. The title card for this week's episode is Andromeda, the runner ID released during the Genesis cycle, and her flavor text is, I run with the best. And if you have a semi-decent memory, maybe you realize I've used that title card once before, back in episode 22. So that's why I differentiated this one by saying, again. But it seems relevant because of how big of an impact Andromeda made in the Netrunner world in 2013 and at Netrunner Worlds in 2013, which is what a lot of this episode is going to be about. In fact, even today in the Reboot Project, the big boy has said a number of times that he thinks Andy Sucker is probably the best runner deck. Normally, of course, when I'm covering data packs, I cover the runner in one episode and the corp in the next. And I covered the runner last episode, but I really wanted to get this in here, so I'm going to go ahead and break format a little bit. I'll cover the corp part next time, since this is really focused on runner. But we do have a couple of more, not pressing, not up-to-date, not modern. What's the word I'm looking for? We have a couple of more of-the-moment pieces of information. Let me get to those first. Breaking news. Balance patch. Yes, we just had a balance patch about a month ago, early February of 2024, and yet another one fell on March 7th of 2024. This one's a little bit smaller, though. Just three cards, and they're all slight nerfs. So here are the comments from the big boy. Breaker Bay Grid. The trash cost has been reduced from 2 to 1. Now, none of these cards are in our current pool, so let me give you a quick rundown on what this card does. Breaker Bay Grid comes in the fourth cycle of cards, which is the last cycle. It is a neutral upgrade, a region upgrade, that reduces the res cost by 5 of cards in this server. Its trash cost has now been, as I said, reduced from 2 to 1. Here's the big boy's comment. In the very early days of Reboot, Breaker Bay Grid had a res cost of 1. It's currently 0, which proved to be such a large hit to its power that there was basically no reason to play HB Glacier over HB Fast Advance. Since the time that this nerf was reverted, ETF, that's Engineering the Future, the core set ID, decks have gotten a number of other tools and have reached a very strong position and a high win rate. Because I believe a res cost nerf to Breaker Bay Grid is still too extreme, we're trying a trash cost nerf instead to encourage more runner interaction. This change makes naked Breaker Bay Grid and campaign servers a lot easier to deal with, and makes Breaker Bay Grid more of a central server liability. Next up is Waldemar 1.0, which is an original Reboot Project card that came in the first booster. It is an HB barrier, Bioroid barrier, the 1.0, probably a clue, and its ability is that it gains a subroutine End the Run for each resed piece of Bioroid ice to a maximum of 6. Originally, its cost res cost was 3, strength 2. Now the res cost is 4. And to go along with it, also from Reflections, that first booster, Next Level Clearance. This is an HB operation that allows you to trash up to 4 resed next ice place that many advancement counters on an installed card. The cost has been changed here from 3 to 4. Here are the big boys' comments. Being booster pack cards, I'm more comfortable being aggressive when balancing Waldemar and next level clearance than with a card from the core pool like Breaker Bay Grid. Although I believe these cards are healthy, they are still proving to be extremely powerful pieces for what is, right now, the statistically best faction. These changes are more about overall faction and side balance than about these two specific cards. The issue is not that they, in particular, are too strong, but that their faction does not need them to be as strong as they are. I am certain they will both still see quite a bit of play. Anonymous tip, the top 50 countdown. Let's pick up where we left off last time. As we get into the top 50 itself, I'll start with the corpse side this time and count down the next 10 cards. In each case, I'll provide the comment that the big boy made as he posted the card. And as I said before, if you want to see some conversation and discussion about these cards, many of them have little threads that have been attached to them, where people have had some more to say. Number 50. The 50th best corp card is a solid vanilla agenda, except when it's not, says the big boy. The card is Project Beal. Number 49. The best tagging ice in the game. It's negative tempo, useless if they go tag me, and countered by a lot of cards, but it does one job and does it extremely well. Data Raven. Number 48. One of the scariest agendas to have scored on you early in the game. House of Knives. This comes from the second deluxe box. We're going to see that in a few months. It's a 3-1 Jinteki agenda that gives three agenda counters, each of which can be spent once during a run to give one net damage. Number 47. The best thing to do with a super tagged runner. Psychographics. Number 46. How the Mighty Have Fallen. Astroscript Pilot Program. Of course, this may have been, it would have been in contention for the number one card in the game in its original incarnation. But now that in the reboot project, you cannot use it to, you can't spend the agenda counter on it. On a card that's been installed this turn, it takes away that ability to just chain agendas really fast. 45. An efficient, if narrow, fast advance tool. Trick of Light. Number 44. An econ combo card that was so strong, we had to nerf it, at least in view of an ID that we haven't seen yet. Oversight. AI. Number 43. An ID that lets you get away with a lot of nonsense. NBN. The world is yours. Number 42. An ID that enabled the first really successful Glacier deck. Jinteki. Replicating Perfection. Number 41. A big-time Glacier Econ card. Eve Campaign. So there's your 50 to 41 on the corpse side. Let's run through the runner cards. Number 50. A classic criminal trick. Emergency Shutdown. 49. A game-changing supplement to the fixed breaker rig. Net Ready Eyes. This comes in the fourth cycle. It is a hardware that you can use to give plus one to an icebreaker, a different one. Each run, so it's not tied to a specific icebreaker, although when you install it, you have to take 2 meat damage, because they take out your eyes and put in cybernetic eyes. 48. The role player that holds the criminal faction together. Special Order. Number 47. He simply says, runner number 47 is me. Imp. It's the big boy's avatar. 46. A pressure card that demands an answer from all but the fastest corpse. Grifter. Number 45. A game-changing, non-icebreaker, breaker. And the final card rated 7 out of 10. David. David here is spelled D4V1D. I'm not going to pronounce it D4V1D. That's just dumb. It's from the third cycle, the second pack, so we're seeing it in a little while here. It gives you 3 power counters to use to break subroutines on ice that has 5 or more strength. You see, because David and Goliath. Number 44, a breaker that you can always count on to be at least decent. Gordian Blade. Number 43, a super unique econ and utility card. Personal Workshop. Number 42, the God of Shuffling. Keyhole. This comes in the very next pack. It's an Anarch program that lets you click to run R&D, and then instead of accessing, you look at the top 3 cards, trash one of them, and then force a shuffle. Number 41, the Queen of Clone Chips, Kate Mac McCaffrey. You may have noticed that we have a lot of these cards, right? So in the corpse side, we only came across 1 card we haven't seen already. On the runner side, we only came across 3. So I commented pretty early on here that the core set comprises about 14% of the total card pool. I suspect that it will comprise a significantly higher percentage of this list than that, which is cool. And the big boy said 36% for corp, 40% for runner. And I think that's what you want. That's sort of it's one of the things that I think Netrunner generally had right through most of his life, was that the core set was a lot of good cards. There wasn't the sort of power creep that is very common in card games. I mean, maybe at least until the end, or until they rotated out a lot of those good cards from the core set. We'll come back next time with the next 10. But again, as I said before, you can go and take a look at it yourself. Here, I'm recording this on Sunday morning. I'm going to go ahead and open up Discord, and I'm going to go look at the top 50 countdown channel. Has nothing been posted today? But he's already posted number 22. See? And I'm only up to number 41. So if you want to get ahead, go to the Discord. Experiential Data, Worlds 2013. This is a follow-on to the last time I talked about this a couple weeks ago. I was going to include this at that time, but it's just too long of an article. In fact, it's so long that it completely booted out my plans to include it with my discussion of the corpse side of Mala Tempora. It is, however, this article was released in December 27th of 2013, so it was written after Mala Tempora had been released, but it, of course, is covering Worlds, which through Worlds, only opening moves was legal. So the last 2 packs we've seen were not legal. This is yet another entry from the satellite uplink from David Sutcliffe, and probably the last time I'm going to be quoting from him, because even though I already talked about, he talked about supermodernism, that was a little after this article was written. I sort of pulled that back to discuss that. And he talked about a couple other decks here and there, but he burned out on the game, came back, burned out again, and then sold all his cards. So he went on to write blogs for a little while about Game of Thrones, then for a long time about X-Wing, and even for a while about Marvel Champions. But his information about Netrunner, this is about the point where it dries up. It's been a good run, though. And I think this is a really interesting article because it really analyzes, you know, sometimes you look at a deck like, oh, well, here's an Andromeda deck, here's an Andromeda deck, or in this case, here are a bunch of them. And I can't look at a deck list. I might be able to see the differences. Oh, well, this card is different or that card is different. But what does that mean? So there's a lot of analysis of that sort here to help sort of finely analyze the differences between a couple of different decks. So I'm just going to read the article. Of course, I'll have a link to it. And one thing that's different about this one, too, before I get started, is because he's comparing multiple different decks, he provided little graphics to go along with them. So I will also link those in the show notes so that you can consult them as he is discussing them. So here we go. Worlds 2013 Andromeda Analysis. It's been nearly 2 months since FFG's World Championship weekend crowned 7 world champs of their many LCG and miniatures card games, including the Netrunner champion, Jens Eriksson, who won the day playing Andromeda and a fast-advancing Haas Bioroid deck. It wasn't the first success that Jens has had from flopping cards. 5 minutes of internet research revealed that the same Jens Eriksson has previously torn it up at some large Yu-Gi-Oh! Tournaments and has made the odd foray into Magic the Gathering's Pro Tour, winning money at Pro Tour Kyoto in 2009, which is no mean feat. So we can be relatively confident that Jens knows his way around card games, and that his success wasn't a random, fluke result. It was also another win for Andromeda, after we watched the dispossessed Risty pick up more than her fair share of wins from the Plugged In Tour a few months back. While many people saw the Plugged In Tour wins as a further sign of Andromeda being unfairly powerful, along with the highest win percentage of any ID on Octagon, there were just as many prepared to defend Andromeda, correctly, claiming that focusing only on the winners was less useful than looking at the top 8, and which other decks had come within a hair's breadth of winning. Well, from Worlds, we can look deeper than just the champion, thanks to the excellent work of Reddit and Board Game Geek stalwart M. Plane, who compiled 25 of the top 32 deck lists from the World Championships. Here are the top 8 from Worlds 2013. First, Jens Eriksson, Andromeda, and HB ETF, Fast Advance. Second, Andrew Veen, Kate Ottman, and NBN Making News, Never Advance. Semifinals, Aaron Andreas, or Andres, I'm not sure, Andreas, Andromeda, and Wayland Building a Better World, Tag and Bag. The other semifinalist, Jesse Vandover, Andromeda, and NBN Making News, Psychographics. The 4 quarterfinalists, Sam McKnight, Andromeda, and NBN The World Is Yours, Fast Advance. Brad Wildenborg, Andromeda, and NBN Making News, Never Advance. Niles Stanley, Andromeda, and NBN Making News, Psychographics. Pat McGregor, Andromeda, and NBN Making News, Never Advance. Boom! 7 out of the top 8 players were running Andromeda. And on the corpse side, there were 6 NBN players, although really, they represented 3 noticeably different decks within the NBN faction. 7 out of 8 of the most successful decks were Andromeda, which is a very strong result. And in fact, there were another 6 Andromeda decks in the other 17 deck lists we have from places numbers 9 through 32. When you stack this alongside Andromeda's dominance during the Plugged In Tour and her dominant win rate on Octagon in non-competitive play, the argument that there is one best runner deck seems very hard to refute. So, if Andromeda locked up nearly the whole of the top 8, does that mean it's the only identity that can win? No, absolutely not. Although she is the only runner ID with an Octagon win percentage much above 50%, 59% from the latest data poll. The dominance of Andromeda at Worlds almost certainly came from a feedback loop of success. Andromeda wins more than other runners. The better players want to maximize their chances of winning, so play Andromeda. And then it's the combination of the best players wielding the best identity that locks pretty much everybody else out of the top 8. Playing Andromeda is certainly not a guarantee of victory. And for a great many Netrunner players, there are better reasons for choosing your identity than the cold, hard truth of wanting to win as much as possible. For example, fun, variety, creativity, wacky combos, personal favorites. But if you are serious about wanting to win a game of Netrunner, you need a very good reason to play any runner ID other than Andromeda. Anatomy of an Andromeda. As well as cementing Andromeda's place as queen of the runners, the fact that we got so many deck lists from the World Championships gives us a great opportunity to look at the makeup of a successful Andromeda deck. What cards are the staples for this identity? What are the common differences between decks? And are there any significant differences between the way Andromeda decks are put together? I've pulled together the 7 deck lists from World's Top 8 to help us understand how Andromeda decks are put together. Here is where you'll want to consult the first chart, Events. Events are the lifeblood of pretty much any criminal deck, and Andromeda in particular. You can see this right here in the way that most of these decks are running over 20 events, with nearly 50% of the average Andromeda deck being a one-off event. The first striking thing is that there are 6 events which appear to be almost compulsory. Sure Gamble, and the dreaded Account Siphon, of course. But also Emergency Shutdown, and Special Order to help assemble your rig of icebreakers. Then Dirty Laundry, and Inside Job. The eventual champion, Erickson, found room for a full 3 copies of each of these 6 cards, while most other players cut a copy or two here and there. Pat McGregor left Inside Job out of his deck altogether, and it looks as though he chose to play more economy resources instead, simply punching through the ice with credits rather than avoiding it with Inside Job. Beyond those 6 essentials for Andromeda, the selection of other events becomes a bit more a matter of personal taste. The humble Easy Mark surprised me with its popularity in the top 8 as 4 players brought it along, while the 3 that didn't all had strong reasons to avoid it. McKnight and Wildenborg were both playing the full 3 copies of Cotty Jones, allowing them to click for 3 credits through their trusty courier resource, while Aaron Andreas was playing a very different sort of Andromeda deck entirely. More on him later. Forged Activation Orders was another common criminal event that Andreas' unusual take on Andromeda left out of his deck, along with Vandover and Stanley. The latter 2 players had another plan for removing problematic ice than Forged Activation Orders, preferring to find influence for Parasite by taking out their R&D interfaces. Jens Eriksson's winning deck made a feature of the new opening moves card, Hostage, which gave him some flexibility in his resource economy and allowed him to consistently force the excellent professional contacts into play without having to spend influence on multiple copies. Professional Contacts is a good fit for a completed criminal deck, as it provides a steady stream of events for the criminal mind to play with. And in matches against damaging decks, it makes it less painful to keep topping up your hand to avoid a flatline. Infiltration was a card often associated with criminals, but was actually rarely played in the top 8. Although I note that for the decks in positions 9 to 32, it was much more common, with those players packing an average of 2 copies. A final note on events must go to Sam McKnight, whose whole deck was set out to take maximum value from his events at the expense of other cards. Where other decks packed R&D interface, McKnight had chosen to run a set of Maker's Eye instead, and then added a couple of quality time to help him ensure a constant flow of events, which he could then replay with same old thing. Switching R&D interface for Maker's Eye cuts costs, but at the expense of the late-game R&D lock threat. It wasn't a popular switch among the top Andromeda decks, although there was another player in the top 32 who made a similar change. If the events in the top 8 decks were quite consistent, then that's nothing next to their use of hardware, where pretty much everyone was of the same mind. And here you'll want to consult chart number 2, hardware. 3 copies of Desperado is an auto-include, it seems, which is painful, as the only way to get 3 Desperado is to buy 3 core sets. And in fact, the only non-Andromeda deck in the top 8 found 9 influence to spend on bringing in 3 copies of Desperado to its Shaper deck. Desperado is just as essential to the dominance of criminal decks as the more obvious culprit, Account Siphon. The credit you get from Desperado is often a sizable cash-back bonus to the cost of making a successful run. And in decks that also run Datasucker and or John Masanori, the synergies of making successful runs start to add up. Corps rightly fear the Account Siphon, but often it's the inexorable economic gains of Desperado runs that put the runner in the driving seat in the first place. All players ran at least 2 copies of their trusty Plazcrete Carapace, with Andromeda decks frequently choosing to remain tagged from Account Siphon, or breezing past cards like Data Raven, and relying on their Carapace to keep the roof from collapsing on their heads. Finally, most of the top 8 ran 2 or 3 copies of R&D Interface, as the card that ultimately grinds out the agenda points from the Corps deck once the runner has established economic dominance. 3 of the top 8 didn't play any R&D Interfaces. Sam McKnight switched his Like for Like with Maker's Eye, as previously discussed, while Vandover and Stanley sacrificed their R&D Interfaces to the Altar of Influence in order to bring in Parasites for their ice destruction plan. Next up is Chart 3, Programs. Datasucker, Corroder, Yogg.0, Mimic. The criminal rig is brutally efficient and almost entirely anarch, with criminals profiting from the criminally low influence cost on the best anarch breakers and programs. Should Yogg.0, Mimic, and Datasucker be just 1 influence apiece? Probably not, but you won't find many Andromeda players arguing with the value they get from that deal, especially when they get their breaker sent to them via FedEx with special order. Once assembled, the Anarch rig is incredibly efficient at breaking through all but a select few pieces of ice. Archer, Tollbooth, Hadrian's Wall are perhaps the most common stumbling blocks. And Mimic alone disables many of the common sentries you will meet. Draco, Caduceus, Shadow, Roto Turret, Neural Katana, for some risk-free running. Playing against the criminal rig can be incredibly disheartening for the Corp. Early on, you feel as though you have a chance, as their fixed-strength icebreakers bump up against bigger problems. But once the supporting elements of Desperado and Datasucker arrive, you will rapidly find that your ice becomes a mere distraction for the runner, and they can bypass it at very little cost. If you can land program destruction on a criminal, then the game swings hugely. They're dependent on those Anarch imports, and can't rebuild them once they're gone, like a Shaper can. But if the criminal gets to make his rig and keep it, it's pretty much game over. Supporting the ubiquitous Anarch rig, usually a couple of Fairy, which act as a get-out-of-jail-free card should any particularly big and ugly sentry be rezzed unexpectedly, and usually Andromeda will play a Crypsis or 2 as backup should anything unfortunate happen to their precious imported icebreakers. Get past those 2 cards, though, and it's rare to find anything else. Maybe the odd Femme Fatale or Ninja. The criminal icebreakers are simply too inefficient to justify a place in the deck, and there is no spare influence to bring in the best Shaper breakers. The only exceptions to the Anarch icebreaker rig were the 2 players who brought Parasite in, and Aaron Andrea's completely different icebreaker rig, which abandoned the Anarch cards entirely for something else. I'll talk about that version of Andromeda in more detail a little later. All the way through the analysis of these decks, from the top 8 of Worlds, it has been largely a case of highlighting the similarities. The decks finally diverge hugely in their approach to resources and the amount that they lean on their back row for economy. Now time for chart 4, resources. A key consideration to bear in mind is that Andromeda decks often play tag me, meaning they are happy to ride through a game with tags and choose not to spend precious credits on avoiding receiving them. When you switch into tag me mode, you can't rely on your resources so much, because the corp can always spend a click and 2 credits to trash them. But in Andromeda, that threat is lessened because the whole deck is hoping to keep the corp poor. If the corp wants to spend a click and some credits to trash a resource, then often Andromeda isn't too sorry to see that happen. That aside, let's look at some of the different approaches to resources in the top 8 decks. Jens Eriksen plays the minimum resources possible, just 3 cards. Although it's probably best to remember he's also playing 2 copies of Hostage, so he's really dedicated 5 cards in his deck to resources. That reduces Eriksen's vulnerability to resource destruction and allows him to be flexible in his response. Against decks that are unlikely to tag him, Eriksen can invest in keeping some professional contacts hostage, or otherwise turn to the trusty Cotty Jones, or the synergetic, or synergistic, I suppose I should be, John Massanori. McGregor and Wildenborg played very similar resource lineups. Cotty Jones, Daily Casts, and John Massanori are really the classic lineup for criminal decks, offering strong economy and great synergy with Desperado Data Sucker runs. There's little more depressing about playing against criminals than when they make a run and finish up with, and I gain a credit from Desperado, put a virus counter on my Data Sucker, and draw a card from John Massanori. That's a lot of little benefits from a single click. Vandover and Stanley played a very different resource base to the classic lineup, though, putting all their eggs into the combination of Compromised Employee and Mr. Lee. Both brought a couple of same old thing. Then one played 2 copies of Daily Casts and the other 2 copies of Cotty Jones. Compromised Employee is a great metagame call when you expect to face a lot of NBN. As with Andromeda's natural +1 link, bzzt, it quickly adds up to great resilience to tags from cards like Shadow, Draco, and Midseason Replacements. It also helps frustrate cards like Caduceus that also rely on successful traces. That's the change, of course. This a version of Andromeda doesn't work because she no longer comes with a link. That's the reboot nerf. Anyway, continuing. Combining the recurring trace credit with the credit gained whenever the corp reses ice means the compromised employee quickly repays the 2 credits invested in getting him on side. Mr. Lee is a powerful card-searching resource who helps you power through your deck and look for specific things, which fits extremely well in a deck full of powerful one-off effects. The thing that both Compromised Employee and Mr. Lee have in common is that they need to stick around a while to really pay off, and that means these variants of Andromeda have to be much more careful about allowing tags to accumulate. The last 2 players used a card that has come in and out of fashion in criminal decks over time, the bank job. When you can bust into a remote server cheaply, the bank job is a great way to boost your funds, and both Andreas and McKnight paired the bank job with a good number of same old things to recur their best events and keep the corp under control. So, that's a bunch of different takes on Andromeda decks to mull over. They're virtually all the same deck, just with minor subtleties and tweaks that focus strengths and weaknesses in one direction or the other. Eriksen brought a small but flexible economy package that was resistant to tags, while other players invested more heavily in Daily Cast, or even more heavily in the slow but powerful advantage gained from Mr. Lee and Compromised Employee. Underneath all the minor differences, though, the common thread of powerful criminal events and an ultra-efficient Anarch rig remains a constant. If you take all those decks and mash them together, what do you get? Average Dromeda by the top 8 players at Worlds 2013. 3 Account Siphon, 3 Sure Gamble, 3 Emergency Shutdown, 3 Special Order, 2 Dirty Laundry, 2 Inside Job, 2 Easy Mark, 2 Forged Activation Orders. 3 Desperado, 2 Plazcrete Carapace, 2 R&D Interface. 3 Data Sucker, 2 Corroder, 2 Fairy, 1 Crypsis, 1 Yogg.0, 1 Mimic, 1 Femme Fatale, 2 Cotty Jones, 1 Same Old Thing, 1 Daily Casts, 1 Compromised Employee, 1 John Masanori, 1 Mr. Lee. You know what that looks a lot like, aside from the resources? That's pretty much Jens Eriksson's winning deck list, which is a bit of a coincidence, but also interesting. The resources look like a bit of a mess as they come from a bunch of different styles of deck, but as a starting deck list for working out how Andromeda works, this is a great jumping-on point for players new to Andromeda. Let's take a look at the other Andromeda. So now we have Chart 5, which shows the events, programs, resources, and hardware in the 3 other decks. Before you go cross-eyed trying to work it out, Myron Michael and Brad Eamon played card-for-card identical deck lists into the top 16, while Aaron Andreas arrived at a similar solution through a slightly different route. Where the other Andromeda decks just tweak their strengths and weaknesses slightly, this deck wrenches the wheel over to one side and makes something very different. The key inclusion is Magnum Opus, and everything in the deck warps around that. Got credits, but not Data Sucker? You'll want Gordian Blade, not Yogg.0, then. And the influence you spend on 2 Magnum Opus and a copy of Gordian Blade is what you traded for 3 Data Sucker, 1 Mimic, 1 Yogg.0, and a Corroder. So what do these Shaper versions of Andromeda gain for switching over? Well, in Magnum Opus, they gain perhaps the best pure credits economy engine in the game, and that gives them a big edge in the NBN matches. Magnum Opus allows you to build up a stash of credits very rapidly to fight off traces and big mid-season replacement attempts. And it also allows you to recover much more quickly from closed accounts. Because your economy is based in programs rather than resources, it's also a lot less trashable from character assassination or breaking news tags. Where Michael and Eamon stick with the original flimsiness of the criminal rig, singleton copies of Gordian Blade and Ninja, for example, Aaron Andreas also adds a lot more resilience to his rig by playing multiple copies of Ninja and Corroder with Crypsis backup. That's what you gain. But what have these decks traded in to gain those strengths? Well, to my mind, they've traded in one of the core reasons why Andromeda is great in the first place, the ultra-efficient rig. In trading out Yogg, Mimic, Data Sucker for Gordian Blades and Ninjas, you lose a ton of efficiency in your breaking, particularly of sentries. The number of pieces of ice that Mimic wanders past for minimal cost, while Ninja has to pay 3 to pump up to 5 strength, is eye-watering. Draco, Caduceus, Katana, Shadow were all among the most common sentries played in the top 8. And paying 10 to break Archer is horrible. So yes, Magnum Opus gives you a ton of credits, but then your Icebreaker rig takes those credits right back and throws them at the corp. I'm not sure the other Andromeda is the right build, but in a metagame dominated by NBN, I can see that the ability to rack up Scrooge McDuck levels of cash in double quick time could be essential. The future of Andromeda. Since the Worlds decks landed, we've had 2 new data packs, Second Thoughts and Mala Tempora. So the question of what comes next for Andromeda is a valid one. What new toys have FFG given the most popular girl in school? None. Nada. Zip. Some cards look slightly tempting. Grifter, prepaid voice pad, running interference. But the existing Andromeda deck lists are so strong that the bar to entry is extremely high, and I don't think any cards have proven that they meet that requirement. But new runner cards is only one impetus towards changing decks. As we've seen from the Magnum Opus variants, the runner has to stay aware of changes in the corporation decks and respond if necessary. In Power Shutdown, the corps have been given a tool that very squarely targets Andromeda, not in a crippling way, but at least enough for runners to sit up and pay attention. As we talked through the cards played at Worlds, I hope I imprinted on you just how crucial the Anarch Breakers are to Andromeda's success. Bringing in such fundamental cards with precious influence is a weak point that Power Shutdown aims to exploit. Trash a data sucker or a corroder, and can Andromeda keep going? Suddenly, the runner has to be really careful about the order in which they play their icebreakers, because you can never afford to have Yogg.0 trashed. Can it ever be the first thing you install? Can you afford to sit Desperado out naked and let the corp shoot at it? We've yet to see how much Power Shutdown will get played, but I suspect that the answer will be a lot, and that will force a change in Andromeda. The most obvious and easiest solution is to simply play more copies of Fairy, which is a card that already fits into the deck and can be sacrificed easily in place of another program or hardware. Beyond that, the Shaper tools of Sacrificial Construct and Clone Chip offer suitable protection, but would probably require the loss of R&D interface in order to gain influence for them. Alternatively, runners could look to cheap criminal hardware for fodder to throw under a Power Shutdown. Cortez Chip or Prepaid Voice Pad have some utility in Criminal's theme and can be happily lost in a power cut. The other possibility is that if corps switch to aggressively destroying programs and hardware, it could be the Shaper version of Andromeda that becomes the dominant version, with the more expensive breakers and more redundant copies, making a Power Shutdown less traumatic. One thing playing in favor of the more expensive breakers in the Shaper version is that as bad publicity becomes more and more common, cards like Ninja will become easier and easier to support. The future for Criminal could well be green, but for now, I'm going to be sticking with orange. Well, that again is the analysis of the Andromeda decks from World 2013 as performed by David Sutcliffe on the Satellite Uplink. Once again, links to all of that stuff in the show notes. Feedback filter. I just wanted to bring you a few comments here. Huggin Ronan and I had a couple of comments back and forth, a conversation after I posted the last episode in the 2.1 channel on the Discord, Reboot Discord server. And I don't know, you told me, Ronan, what the best, like you said, every time you hear your name pronounced that way, you kind of laugh a little bit. And I said, well, how's it supposed to be pronounced? And we went back and forth, and I don't remember now. What was it I said? You'll have to tell me. What was it I said about your name that you thought was funny? But it looks like Huggin Ronin to me. H-U-G-I-N-R-O-N-I-N, the H and the R capitalized. I don't know. I just kind of figured it was a Ronin that was huggable. Anyway, three things that he brought out. First, he said that Mala Tempora Corunt, I'm going to say Corunt, is an actual Latin phrase. So very likely that's where Mala Tempora comes from, that Latin phrase, not Spanish. Although what that means is still the same thing, bad times. Mala Tempora Corunt means bad times are upon us. Or if you want to be more dramatic or poetic, you could say evil times or wicked times or dark times are upon us. I mentioned that Reina Roja made me think it was Spanish, but he suggested the Caissa might make you think that it is more of a classical theme. Because he said, to be fair, Caissa is made up of Latin or Greek, right? And I said, yeah, I think it's Greek. And in fact, if you go to Wikipedia, which is very reliable, at least I think for things like this, they refer to Caissa as a fictional, anachronistic, Thracian Dryad, portrayed as the goddess of chess. And Ronan's comment was, point being, they made it up in the Renaissance because they didn't have chess back in ancient Greece and needed to glorify it. My favorite thing I learnt from Netrunner. Unquote. And then the third comment, he said, I was super into the Tag Me Anarch until you revealed the secret sauce was funny blue card. Ronan has, he joined the reboot server about the same time I did, I want to say, maybe a little bit after. He's been much more in the dialogue, has jumped much more deeply into the game. I've sort of waded into the shallow end, and he dove right into the deep end. But he's had a lot of comments and expressed his frustration about Account Siphon and dealing with Account Siphon and how he doesn't like Account Siphon and doesn't want anything to do with Account Siphon. So when in the Anatomy of Anarch deck, Stephen Woolley says, hey, go tag me, and here's the great thing you're going to want, Account Siphon. Well, he wasn't happy. So I said, I almost called you out as I was reading that. I almost did. I almost said something. Well, I'll say something now. There you go. Your Account Siphon, Ronan. Anyway, many of the cards discussed in this week's episode are linked in the show notes. Music is from Alexi Action. The website is netrunner2.1.com. That will redirect you to the Reboot Project homepage where you can read about all the show notes, that's not there. But what is there is the patch notes and links to all of the changes the Reboot Project has made. Good stuff. Go look for it. You can go to the Reboot Discord server, links there, and go to retechie.fun to play online. In the AstroScript pilot program this time around, we'll cover the sixth part of our series on clones in Jinteki. It's an eight-part series, by the way, so we're closing in on the end. This time we'll talk about clonal medicine and clone etiquette. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Clonal medicine. The technology behind AIVM was developed from techniques used for biomedical research, but the advent of clones has since unlocked near limitless applications of the new technology and new opportunities for advancements. Such innovations as cloned organ replacements, genomic enhancements, and accelerated drug testing have improved the lives of people the world's over. Replacement. Organ failure due to deterioration, disease, or catastrophic injury was the most common cause of death for humans. The same technologies used to grow clones can grow parts of clones, such as individual organs, and the availability of these replacements have virtually eliminated this cause of death. The Universal Donor, UD, clone line is designed to produce organs with antigens that do not trigger transplant rejection. Modern hospitals keep UDs on the premises in their original vats. A UD can be decanted, an organ quickly harvested, and a transplant performed on demand. UD transplants are available for all internal systems, and even limbs, with the exception of the brain and central nervous system. Unfortunately, the nature of the UD line's universality means that its one-size-fits-all replacement limbs can be awkward for some recipients. To overcome this, most facilities offer to grow UD clones to a custom size and also offer cosmetic modifications to ensure that the skin tone and appearance matches the recipient's other limb. Growing replacements takes 2 to 3 weeks, so some opt to make do with a cybernetic replacement limb during the interim. Alternatively, clones can be custom grown using a recipient's own DNA to ensure the best possible match. This requires a skilled gene engineer to optimize the AIVM process for the patient's genome, which typically adds several weeks to to the growth time, and several digits to the price tag. The affluent, those who work particularly high-risk jobs, and those who have exceptionally good insurance policies, often choose to maintain a clone created from their own DNA at a local facility. If a replacement organ or limb is required, it can be immediately harvested. In extreme cases, multiple organs can be replaced. And legends persist that the richest Ristis may simply choose to transplant their brain into the healthy clone's body. Even if such technology existed, the extreme surgery would require an extended recuperation time, since the brain must learn to control its new body. Paparazzi cam drones fuel conspiracy theories about stars undergoing cosmetic surgery or more dramatic procedures. Enhancement. In addition to stock organs, Gentechi can also supply organs that are enhanced in numerous ways. These are typically derived from UD lines to ensure that the replacements are available for the largest possible client base, but the clones are further tweaked so a specific organ is dramatically enhanced. This can include lungs, optimized for performance in extreme conditions, muscles that offer faster twitch response, or even neuronal tissues capable of expanding the brain's function. Once the clone and relevant tissues have properly matured, the clone is decanted and the tissues are removed for transplant into a waiting patient. The remainder of the clone is then recycled. Due to the modifications required to optimize enhanced tissues, the integrity of other organs are typically less than ideal. Because of scaling and proportionate growth concerns, it remains substantially more economical to produce an entire clone and recycle the undesirable materials than it is to synthesize an organ in isolation. Research. Clones, specifically those produced through AIVM, have revolutionized pharmaceutical testing. Newly discovered medications can be thoroughly tested on clones, which are entirely synthetic and artificial in their creation, rather than in animals. This has dramatically reduced the time required for testing between initial discovery and when drugs can be administered to patients. Side effects are also more easily identifiable because a clone's entire environment is effectively controlled, thereby making any anomalies far easier to identify. It has also expanded the functionality of pharmacogenetics, as different clone lines can be quickly created to test drug efficacy in patients with different genetic markers. As a consequence, once a patient's genome is on file, physicians can be certain that they are prescribing a drug that is known to be effective within the patient's specific genetic background. Clone etiquette. Excerpted from Modern Manners. Given their humanoid appearance, it can be easy to mistake a clone for a real person at first glance. Yet, anyone who has tried conversing with a clone that wasn't designed to regularly interact with humans will tell you that it can be an awkward experience. When talking to clones, keep in mind that not all models had social intelligence developed as part of their psychological profile. But they are all conditioned to be subservient and respectful toward you and me. A good clone will rarely be seen and is never heard. Clones are trained to give room on the slidewalk or lift, and they will stand still and face the speaker if addressed directly. They are conditioned to rise when non-android enters the room and will hold the door open for him when he leaves. Clones are often employed in behind-the-scenes roles, but if you do happen across one during the course of its duties, acknowledging it will only draw attention to its shortcomings. Clones are expected to defer to a human being in all things. Clones will not speak unless spoken to, except for the most perfunctory of pleasantries, or if their duties require them to relay information to humans. It is inconsiderate of a human to engage a clone in a conversation above its ability level, such as discussing politics or philosophy. Moreover, clones' conditioning discourages them from disagreeing or causing any affronts during an exchange. Along those same lines, clones will not speak about their owners' personal lives, nor will polite people try to encourage or trick them into doing so. Clones not working in the service sector do not have the empathy or the experience to recognize human social cues. A human should never make use of subtle hints, polite denials, or sarcasm with such a clone. While clones do have some ability to recognize these cues, their innate tendency to defer to a human's expectations can lead to unfortunate misinterpretations of literal phrases. It is always more appropriate to be as direct and literal as possible when dealing with a clone, so as to avoid such misunderstandings. Using a raised or authoritarian voice is also considered impolite, but to do so in front of others can be a sign of disrespect toward the owner himself. Clones are designed to want to please their owners and other humans, and they will respond equally well to a firm command as to an admonition, so it is unnecessary to yell. Doing so only causes distress and may even have other negative side effects. On the other hand, if a clone begins to raise its voice, express its opinions, or use crude language, it is possible it has learned such permissiveness from its owner.